They missed the deadline today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. A court ordered the Trump administration to reunite all families separated at the border under the zero-tolerance policy by today. But a lot of those families aren't back together yet.
There are more than 900 parents still separated from their kids.
Also today, remembering Aiko Hirsig-Yoshinaga, her research helped force the U.S. government to apologize for its treatment of Japanese Americans during World War II.
This is a woman who, dedicated 40 years of her life to exposing the truth about Japanese American incarceration.
Plus, the key to a lizard's survival in a tropical storm, big toes.
The larger they are, the better they can hold on to things.
Those stories and more coming up today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Today is the deadline for the Trump administration. The U.S. government has been scrambling to meet a court order to reunify migrant families separated at the U.S.-Mexico border. It all started officially with the U.S. government's new zero-tolerance immigration policy this spring. Families that crossed the border illegally were separated. Parents were detained and criminally prosecuted, while their children were taken away, perhaps thousands of miles away. And we all heard what followed. Frightened children crying for their moms and dads, parents desperate to find out where their kids ended up. Back in May, Attorney General Jeff Sessions was unapologetic about what was coming.
If you don't want your child to be separated, then don't bring them across the border illegally. It's not our fault that somebody does that.
As we all know now, a federal court disagreed. The government was ordered to reunite all the children who were separated under zero tolerance by today. But The World's Monica Campbell says that hasn't happened.
Not all of the families will be reunited. The government said that it's on track to reunite more than 1,600 parents with their children. And those reunifications are happening at a faster rate than we've seen. But this group, it's important to point out that this group is the group that the government has deemed eligible to be reunited. There are more than 900 parents still separated from their kids.
So are you saying that there is a whole different class of parents and children who are ineligible for reunification?
There are, and there are a few reasons for that. In some cases, the government says that the parents have a criminal record or charges, and that reuniting the parent with the child could endanger the child, so they're blocked from being reunified, at least for now. But more than half of this group of more than 900 parents have already been deported from the country without their children.
That's incredible. What can we say about those families now separated by deportation of ever being reunited?
It's going to be incredibly difficult. Government officials say that those parents gave their written consent to be deported. That is being challenged very strongly by advocates who say that some of the migrants feel that they were not aware of what they were signing and that they didn't get a chance to stay and fight their case within the United States and be reunited with their child in the U.S.
Well, as you know, on The World, we followed one story of a family from Guatemala that was separated at the border, a mom who crossed the border at Texas with her little girl who was 5 at the time.
Right. This story actually started last summer when the zero tolerance policy was being piloted in Texas. So the family, the mom and the little girl, they left Guatemala. The mother was fleeing a man who was abusing her, domestic violence. They were separated at the border. The mom was eventually deported back to Guatemala. And now the little girl, who's 6 years old, is with her great aunt in Florida. So we've been checking in with this family, Ashley. The reporter's been checking in. And this is what the mother from Guatemala told us the other day about keeping in touch with her daughter, who is now in Florida.
I spoke to Maria on Friday, and she said she was doing well. Maria asked when I was going to go see her, and I said I wasn't sure. There's no date for us to see each other. And Maria mentioned that she doesn't want to go back to Guatemala.
I just want to note that the mother was speaking an indigenous language there, which is actually not uncommon right now among many of the parents that have been separated from their children. It's not; these are not just Spanish speakers. These are people who are also speaking other languages, which is another hurdle.
Right, right. So Magdalena, the mom, was deported. What do we know from the latest check-in with the family?
Well, the mother signed her deportation order, and the government can point to that and say, well, you agreed to be deported. So for her to come back to the United States, it's an uphill battle. She doesn't have a lawyer. She's very in a very isolated part of Guatemala. So what the family is facing is are some really tough choices. Will the family seek asylum for the daughter in the United States? And what will that mean for example, the parental rights of the mom anymore? I mean, will she have to give up her rights to her child in order for her child to remain in the United States? These are the type of choices that we may be seeing families face, especially parents who are being deported without their children.
And what about the families that are being reunited now, still in the U.S.? What scenarios are they facing?
Well, some parents are being held with their children together in family detention, many of them in Texas. Some parents are being released with ankle monitors and may have a chance at a hearing before a judge to try and seek asylum. But many advocates are very concerned that many of these parents are making decisions in the dark. One of the lawyers on this call, her name is Shaylin Flaherty. She's in Texas. She talked about how traumatized some parents feel having been separated from their children, being reunited, and that they feel too broken down to fight their case. This is what she said on a call with several reporters.
We have stories of mothers who have expressed to us not even recognizing their child at the time of reunification because their children had lost so much weight. We are hearing daily stories from mothers who are learning about what has happened to their child while they have been outside of their care. And so these decisions are really impossible decisions for our clients to make at this time while they're unpacking such traumatic circumstances in the moment and are faced with what seem to us to be very difficult decisions.
Monica, what should we be looking for next with this story?
We'll know soon whether a federal judge in San Diego will say that families being reunited right now in the United States with their children must have some breathing room before they face deportation. Can they fight it? They need some time to regroup. And we're hearing from lawyers that some parents are being given forms, sometimes only in English, and they feel pressured to make decisions within minutes. Some parents are saying that they're not seeking asylum because they say that if they do, they might not see their child again. So there's a decision that we'll hear from soon from this judge in San Diego about whether there should be a pause on having these deportations happen so quickly.
Monica Campbell, the World's Global Nation editor, thanks very much.
You're welcome, Marco.
We've been talking a lot about tariffs and trade on the show this week, but one sector we haven't heard much about is the newspaper industry. Earlier this year, the Trump administration slapped temporary tariffs on Canadian uncoated groundwood paper. That's the newsprint that becomes your newspaper. The tariffs came partly in response to a complaint from North Pacific Paper Company, a.k.a. NORPAC. It's a paper mill in Washington state. Practically, it means that Canadian newsprint now costs up to 30% more than it used to. That is a big jump. But it's also meant that U.S. producers have raised their prices to match Canadian imports. All of this has newspaper publishers here worried.
This really is a tax. You know, I have a $23,000 tax on my business now. That inhibits my ability to hire reporters and produce pages of news that goes on in my community.
Andrew Johnson is with the National Newspaper Association. It represents more than 2,000 small community papers. He's also a publisher of three weeklies serving communities in Wisconsin. We got in touch with Johnson to find out how these new tariffs will affect that slice of the industry.
For me, in my particular case, it's a 21% increase in my printing bill. It's quite frankly a devastating amount of money. And I sure hope that we can get this resolved, because if we do not get it resolved, most newspapers in the United States are small community weeklies like myself. There's about 7,000 total of the weeklies and under 2,000 dailies. And I would suspect that half of them would probably go out of business. That's just too much of a burden to carry.
So why are small newspapers in the U.S. not turning to U.S. newsprint producers if the tariffs on Canadian newsprint is making the product too expensive?
The prices are relatively the same. It really doesn't matter whether you buy from Canadians or Americans. You're not going to save money necessarily by going to an American company. I don't think that's an issue.
So what you're saying is by putting tariffs on Canadian newsprint to favor U.S. newsprint companies, Donald Trump is basically not getting what he wants.
I think in the long term he's not, because he's going to decrease the demand for newsprint, and less newsprint will be used now because it's cost prohibitive to guys like me. And so I'm going to either have to cut the amount I use in order to keep my numbers the same, or I'm going to have to let people go. I let a person and a half go for the in response to the tariff. It doesn't seem like much, but when you realize that there's 7,000 weekly newspapers like me, and that the average weekly newspaper has let a person and a half go, that is a lot of people. In the argument of NORPAC, they have about 265 jobs they're trying to save, and when in fact you have a tremendous, a large number of jobs at risk, far greater than the than the NORPAC company has.
I mean, and it's not just small community papers that are affected by this. Apparently, when the Tampa Bay Times announced job cuts early this year, they pointed to rising newsprint prices. In terms of long-term impact, what do you think this will do to local community journalism?
Well, I think that it will certainly impact the local community journalism if the tariffs stay in place. What you're going to see is a reduction in page sizes. You're going to see a reduction in page counts, and you're going to see a reduction in overall journalism. You know, even online, like my little newspaper, I don't have an online reporter. I don't have enough return on dollars to sell online advertising. We're in a very small rural market, and it doesn't work. So the printed paper is how I make my living, and 75% of my income comes from advertising in my printed paper in my local community, like the hardware stores, the meat markets, the grocery store.
Sure.
Those are my customers. And so if I don't have paper, pretty much I'm out of business.
Well, we should recognize that there are other factors at play that have been affecting the newspaper industry for years now. Circulation numbers falling because of migration to online platforms, and also cable TV, advertising revenues dropping. Are we putting too much of the blame on these tariffs?
No, I think they're two separate issues. I think for the past 20 years, you are correct, the industry, the consumption of newsprint has been declining for 20 years. However, in the small towns, though, my newspapers for the last couple of years, in fact, my circulation's up a little bit over last year, and the small towns are a lot different than the big towns. And it is also true, though, that there is no one else on the local level that is replacing us. For example, in Wisconsin, we've got about, I guess, 2,500 people working in the newspaper industry. And in your electronic industry, the radio and television, you have a substantially a lot less. And what's happening when we have news events in these rural communities, no one else will come but us.
You're saying there are no good alternatives for people in those communities?
No,
I mean, not even like local blogs or anything?
Very few that will consistently do it. There are some local blogs, but as far as fair, honest journalism goes, it is extremely difficult. I have not seen it work anywhere at the small community level, unless there's a tie to a big company or there's a tie to some other organization. But I'm talking about true independent journalism in rural towns.
That was Andrew Johnson with the National Newspaper Association. He also owns three community newspapers in Wisconsin. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. This week, we got the sad news that Aiko Hirsig Yoshinaga died. She was a key player in the Japanese-American redress movement of the 1980s. Hirsig Yoshinaga was the researcher who uncovered key documents that eventually forced the U.S. government to apologize for the detention of Japanese-Americans during World War II. Years later, this is how she described her work.
I took it upon myself to do what some people call unnecessary extra work. But I documented everything I got, exactly where I found it. What file, what box, what record group, and everything else. So that when the commission wrote its report, people couldn't say, how can that be? Here is proof.
the late Aiko Yusei Hoshinaga, speaking there in 2009. That clip is courtesy of Densho, a nonprofit dedicated to documenting the Japanese-American experience. Nina Wallace is Densho's communications director. She's in Washington. So, Nina, more than 100,000 Japanese-Americans were sent to camps across the U.S. during World War II. Some have called them internment camps, and in a moment we'll get to the language of all this and why that was so important to Hirsig Yoshinaga. But there was a formal compensation, an apology to Japanese-Americans from the Reagan administration in 1988. Would you say that that was largely thanks to Hirsig Yoshinaga's research?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, Aiko was the lead researcher for the Congressional Commission that investigated the forced removal and the incarceration of Japanese Americans during World War II. So she put in, 50, 60, 70-hour weeks in the National Archives investigating the government's documents on this, trying to expose what really happened. And she was responsible for finding what was really considered a smoking gun that supported that redress passage. She found a military document that admitted that there was no military necessity to remove Japanese Americans from the West Coast. And that was the basis of the Civil Liberties Act and the issuing of redress checks to Japanese Americans.
You tweeted at the New York Times recently saying to fix the headline of their obituary on Aiko Hirsig Yoshinaga. What did they write and what issue did you take with the way they wrote it?
So I do have mixed feelings about it. I was really glad to see the New York Times cover her and, honor her memory, because she was just such a huge figure in the community. And, her importance really can't be understated. Using that word, so in their headline, it says that, Aiko was a, critic of the wartime internment. In a way, she was a critic, because she was a critic of that terminology. This is a woman who, dedicated 40 years of her life to exposing the truth about Japanese-American incarceration. And that includes the language that we use to describe that experience. And so for someone who, was so passionate about shining light on that history and exposing the truth and talking directly about what happened, it feels disrespectful to sort of use her name to perpetuate some myths about that history. I would like to see the New York Times reflect and respect the work that she put in by using the information that she helped to spread.
Nina, what do you call these camps? What should we all call them?
I call them concentration camps. And I understand that it is a sort of contentious term for some people. A lot of times when we hear that term, what we immediately think of is the concentration camps in Nazi Germany and in Nazi-occupied territory during World War II. So for a lot of folks, there is that connection to the Holocaust. When I use that word, when Densho uses that word, it is the preferred terminology for a lot of Japanese American organizations and individuals. When we use that term, it's not to try to equate what happened to Japanese Americans during World War II to, what happened during the Holocaust. But it's really just to use the correct terminology to avoid euphemisms and to call things as they are. So during World War II, FDR, very high-level government officials, they referred to these sites where Japanese Americans were imprisoned as concentration camps. The use of internment or, relocation center, some of these euphemisms that we hear today, those came about later on. And so those are really sort of rewriting history. They don't reflect what actually happened and what these places were called at the time.
So in respect to Hirsig Yoshinaga, we should not use the euphemism internment camp, but also for the descendants of people who died in concentration camps in Germany, it gets confused there. It gets conflated. How do you square that circle?
I think even in that case, concentration camp, you could argue, is a euphemism there, because what happened at those sites, those were death camps. Those were places that were set up specifically to engineer a genocide. So I think that, you know, across the board, we should be using language that reflects what really happened.
The stories we've heard from these camps where Japanese Americans were sent in the U.S. during the war, they're filled with tales of misery and dehumanization. What stands out for you from Hirsig Yoshinaga's experience and what she took forward into the rest of her life?
I think for me, what really stands out when we think about Aiko's story is that, you know, she didn't just accept what happened and sort of forget about it and, you know, try to just kind of keep quiet, which is what a lot of people did and, you know, was a survival tactic for a lot of folks. But what's really unique about Aiko is that, you know, she said, no, like, I am going to stand up for myself. I'm going to find out what really happened. I'm going to tell the world what the government did to me, what my own government did to me. You know, so often when we hear stories about Japanese Americans or, you know, specifically about Asian American women, there's sort of this idea that, you know, we are quiet, that we don't raise our voices, that, you know, we have to sort of make ourselves small. And so to see Aiko, you know, just really being such a huge monumental figure is really powerful.
How will you remember Aiko Hirsig Yoshinaga?
Oh, I mean, she's such an inspiration. I think that just her commitment to her community, her commitment to justice, not just for Japanese Americans, but, you know, for anyone who is being targeted, anyone who is marginalized, you know, just because of who they are. I think that, you know, that is her legacy, just to, you know, to do what is right, you know, even if it's not the easy thing, do what's right.
Nina Wallace with Densha, the Japanese American Legacy Project, speaking with us from Washington. Thanks very much, Nina, for helping us remember Aiko Hirsig Yoshinaga.
Thank you.
I'm Marco Werman. Andrei Lenkov has been studying North Korea for a long time, and he thinks the symbolism of President Trump's recent summit with Kim Jong-un will only go so far with the hard-nosed realists who run Pyongyang.
People who don't care about symbols, they care about money, power, and guns.
That story is still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. The message today from the state-controlled news media in North Korea, let's end the war. Tomorrow is the 65th anniversary of the close of the Korean War. Remember that the fighting stopped with an armistice, not a fully realized peace treaty. That means the U.S. and North Korea are technically still at war. The Trump administration says it's committed to peace on the Korean Peninsula so long as the North gives up its nuclear weapons. To get a reality check on where things stand now, we turn to Andrei Lenkov. He's a professor at Gumin University in South Korea. But his Russian background gives him some special insight into how the North Korean system works.
Soviet Union and North Korea parted ways decades ago, but there are some similarities in the ideology, in the political structure, so it helps.
6 weeks ago, President Trump met face-to-face with Kim Jong-un in Singapore. For some, it was a hopeful moment. So I asked Professor Lenkov what he thought.
I had no hope during the Singapore summit, and I don't have much hope now. First of all, neither North Korea nor United States are going to start a war. There used to be a reasonably high risk of a unilateral U.S. military operation last year, but not much more. However, North Korea has no intention to surrender its nuclear weapons. Officially, the major goal of negotiations between the United States and North Korea is to achieve the denuclearization of North Korea. But there is one problem. North Korean government, North Korean elite, not only Kim Jong-un, but many, many thousands of people around him, everybody who matters in North Korea, believes that if their country surrenders nuclear weapons, it will go away of Iraq and Libya and they don't want it. They see it as a suicide, and they have not the slightest intention to do it.
Even with President Trump shaking hands with Kim Jong-un, I mean, that never really happened with Iraq and with Libya. I mean,
So what is magical about shaking hands with the United States president? Does he have some kind of supernatural power in his hands? Well, maybe. Well, in the past, in medieval eras, people believed something like that about kings.
But, I mean, it's not not a supernatural power, but, I mean, it is symbolic, don't you agree?
Well, symbolism is great, but it's cheap and meaningless. North Korea is run by hard-nosed realists, people who don't care about symbols. They care about money, power, and guns.
What about the story that's come out in recent days about the North Koreans beginning to dismantle a key missile facility? How big of a step is that?
It's not a key missile facility. It's one of many missile facilities. What's happened? Last year, it looked like that U.S. administration, Trump administration, was ready to strike North Korea if they don't make any concessions. At the same time, American diplomats succeeded in creating a united front with China. So China joined an unprecedented, tough sanctions regime. Essentially, North Korea was banned from conducting any foreign trade starting from early this year. So economic crisis and probability of American military attack. Is it nice? Definitely not. North Koreans decided to start making concessions, as little as possible. As few as possible, but they decided to give up something. There were some unilateral concessions. All are reversible, and it's going to continue. Meanwhile, Trump administration started a trade war with China. United front on the North Korean issues between U.S. and China collapsed. China is not that serious about sanctions anymore. North Korea is quietly trading with China. They get a bit of money, and it's highly unlikely that U.S. military threat should be taken seriously in the near future, but they have to play safe. So what we are going to see, typical North Korean tactics, they will work hard to win time. There will be some concessions, like this test site. It's not expensive. It can easily be rebuilt, but they will make a wonderful show of it.
Andrei Lenkov, you're in Washington right now. What kind of information or what kind of sense are you getting there in the U.S. Capitol from what's going on in North Korea?
Many opportunities were wasted the last few months, but some opportunities still exist. And many people in Washington believe that using these opportunities, it will be possible to get some concessions, some meaningful reduction of the North Korean nuclear and missile threat. Non-denuclearization, almost nobody among the Korean specialists believe denuclearization is possible. But arms reduction, it's still probably achievable, and let's hope that something will happen. Just let's not have exaggerated hopes, exaggerated expectations.
You know, years ago, John Bolton, who is now the national security advisor to President Trump, described North Korea as a hellish nightmare. Is that still the case? Would you agree with him now or then?
There were periods in North Korean history when it was a fairly good description. But now I would not agree. It's a nightmare which is getting less and less hellish and less nightmarish. Economy is growing. Nobody is starving. A lot of people are malnourished, but nobody is starving. At least, you know, poor people can eat corn gruel every day. Well, richer people can have some protein. There are many power-assisted bikes and a lot of construction. Life is getting better. And even in terms of political repression, yes, country is extremely brutal. But you can pay a bribe. And in most cases, they probably just turn a blind eye to minor illegalities of political nature. And when it comes to daily life, well, as long as you are not engaged in violent crime, they don't care whether you follow outdated instructions from the Stalinist era, because essentially country's economy is driven by market economy, by capitalist economy.
Do you remember the hack of the Sony Entertainment
yes.
hack?
Yeah.
A lot of fingers were pointing to
yes.
North Korea after the movie The Interview as a kind of act of revenge. Was North Korea able to do that on their own? Did they need help from Russia?
I don't think they would ever get help from Russia and from China, as a matter of fact, too. Of course, they did it on their own, and they have very good hacking capabilities. Basically, my computer is attacked by them maybe a couple of once every 2 months or so, and it's not only me. All North Korean specialists have this problem. They keep trying to get into our computer using quite sophisticated methods. They are very active hackers, based usually outside the country, China, Southeast Asia, Malaysia, Indonesia, all places. Small groups of North Korean hackers are operating. They are doing quite well. They are highly professional.
Andrei Lenkov is a professor of Korean studies at Gumin University in Seoul. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Russian hackers, of course, are highly professional, too. The Department of Homeland Security announced this week that hacking groups linked to the Russian government targeted hundreds of U.S. electric companies in 2016 and 17. The hackers wanted to access power grids. One official said, quote, they got to the point where they could have thrown switches. But some experts say that's a bit misleading. Robert Lee is the CEO of the cybersecurity company Dragos. It helped investigate cyber attacks on Ukraine's power grid in 2016 and 17. I asked him if the type or frequency of attacks on U.S. utilities have changed.
There has absolutely been an increase in activity of industrial-specific targeting. Normally, the security community sees targeting of enterprise networks at energy companies and manufacturing companies, but not really down into the industrial networks where the actual control and operations takes place, or not very often, at least.
And just define for us the difference between an enterprise network and industrial network.
The enterprise network is what you'd expect when you walk into your office and you have your laptops or PCs and you've got email and you can browse to the internet, you know, your day-to-day infrastructure that companies use. But when you're talking about industrial networks, you're talking more of systems that are controlling physical processes. You're looking at opening and closing circuit breakers. You're looking at manufacturing lines. And so those environments are usually segmented away from the internet. And the reason to target those sort of ranges not only from the typical espionage, but also in going and doing more military-styled actions, which I think is what concerns many of us. It's undeniable that the activities become more numerous and aggressive.
So what's been happening in a typical attack? What are they doing?
So what we have seen is there are attackers getting into those industrial networks and spying. It's the type of early reconnaissance type activity that you'd expect an adversary to do if they wanted to develop an attack. Now, whether they have the intention to actually do it or not, or if we'd be successful is an entirely different discussion, but it's still concerning. And I think this goes to the most recent news where the Department of Homeland Security was sort of advertising out that there was all these various victims. But what I think was missing from the conversation is people were talking about throwing switches and causing blackouts. And that's not actually what was taking place. It was early reconnaissance to be able to even think about doing that. In other words, the adversary was not in a position to cause blackouts across the U.S., but it is absolutely the type of activity that we're highly concerned about because we don't want an adversary to be in a position to know or learn or develop a capability to do that.
Well, not just concern, but there is also this other worry that the Russians are sticking their toes in the water in advance of some big serious attack. What do you make of that theory?
Well, I think it's a solid one. And we've seen this for years. The electric grid has been probed and targeted for a long time now. And we first started seeing major intrusions back in probably 2011, 2012 timeframe. The first ever cyber attack that took down electric power systems happened in Ukraine in 2015. So I got to lead up a portion of that investigation. And what we found effectively was that it wasn't malicious software or malware alone that was doing these things. It was human adversaries breaking in, learning the systems, and using them against themselves. It happened again in 2016 in Ukraine, and then in 2017, it was the first time that malicious software was developed specifically to kill people. It was the first time I've ever seen sort of the civilians be directly targeted, and there was an attack on a petrochemical plant in Saudi Arabia. It failed and didn't work, but it is getting more aggressive, and I think that's what is concerning to people.
So I'm just curious what you think about the timing of the announcement on Monday, because most of the attacks that DHS has been referencing happened in 2016 and 2017.
And this isn't the first time they made the announcement. The early discovery of this was actually my firm in Symantec finding these intrusions and working and reporting it to DHS and others. And that was a couple years ago now. And the first time we saw them talk about it was actually in February or March. They came out and did presentations and actually attributed it to the Russian state. I thought that was a good approach. I thought the private sector finding things, learning things, passing it on to government, government adding their own mix into it was appropriate. What I think has left the community a little bit confused is the DHS didn't do as effectively as they could have was denote what was new. To say, hey, here's what we already knew. Here was the old information that we're reamplifying and why. And here's the new information and why we're telling it to you now. There's obviously something. And I think a component of this is as states start seeing more and more of this activity, there's almost this race for parity where states want to be able to have similar capabilities. And I think this is where it can sound really, really scary. I mean, it's bad. I don't think anybody can look at this problem and say that we're all okay. But I think what usually is missing is the reality of how these attacks occur and what the impact could be and just the really good work that our infrastructure players are already doing. The electric grids in the United States, there's not one grid, but multiple. These are extremely resilient systems. They're built to be able to come back after hurricanes and storms. And that resiliency that people have built into our infrastructure makes it more defensible. We still have to go and do more. We have to add cybersecurity in a way that makes those systems highly defended. But to say that an adversary could just walk in too easily and do what they want, I think is misleading.
We've been warned about a cyber 9/11 for years. What would that look like? And is that what worries you the most?
Yeah, that's not what worries me the most. And that's where I think the hype and the rhetoric has got a little bit away from itself. Cyber 9/11, Cyber Pearl Harbor. People make it out to be these massive events that are going to change the course of history. And it's not that these high impact, low frequency events can't happen. I think we should absolutely prepare and be concerned about them. But over focusing on them with that fear, I think it takes away from the fact that small impacts can happen. And I think we have to think about and prepare for what I consider to be a very bad scenario, which would be a more localized event. If you are a foreign adversary or foreign power and you're looking to impact a state, even by getting into systems, you cause fear. And as you scare the population, as you scare politicians, as you make them nervous, there's political power in that. I think a 30-minute power outage in Washington, D.C. wouldn't kill anybody, but it would have an immense psychological impact for folks about a foreign power turning off the lights. And I think the knee-jerk reaction was going to be harsh. And that's also why I kind of try to downplay the hype and the fear a little bit to say, look, we have to live in a world where we accept that somebody might be able to turn off the lights and it's not going to be the end of the world. Our grid is resilient. We're going to work to try to prevent that. But if we keep making it seem like this doomsday effect, when it happens, our own knee-jerk reaction back on regulation and the ways that we try to address it might be more crippling than the attack itself.
Robert Lee is CEO of the cybersecurity company Dragos. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much.
Sometimes a little serendipity is all you need with science. In this case, lizard science. Colin Donahue is a Harvard researcher who spent time on those far-flung Caribbean islands of the Turks and Caicos last September. He was studying a small lizard called the anole. When Hurricanes Irma and Maria hit the islands just days after he left, he took advantage of the abnormal conditions. He quickly returned to study how the storms had impacted the lizard population.
We'd found that the hurricanes had actually induced natural selection in the populations. The lizards had changed in several different traits related to how well they can hold on to branches in high winds.
Get this, their special grippy toe pads were bigger after the hurricanes, and the front arms of the lizards were longer, better for wrapping around a branch and hanging on for dear life.
We think that the cause of this huge change in both of the populations was just because the storms had simply wiped out the lizards with smaller toe pads and shorter arms.
And when we're talking huge limbs, how big are we talking?
So the difference in the limbs was subtle. The forelimbs were on average about 2% longer, and the toe pad change was actually larger, closer to 9%. So the changes were subtle. We probably wouldn't have noticed them just by holding the lizards in our hands, but that the changes were consistent between the two populations that we looked at made us confident that this wasn't just a fluke.
It's kind of surprising. Were you surprised?
I was surprised. You know, going back to Turks and Caicos so soon after our first visit, I really wasn't sure what to expect. I mean, we had some hypotheses about traits that are usually related to gripping ability, but these hurricanes were just so intense that we really didn't know if survival would just be random, luck of the draw, instead of related to some of these traits of the lizards themselves. So running around catching the lizards, we really weren't sure what we were going to find. And it was only until after all of the measurements were in and the numbers crunched that we realized that a natural selection had taken place.
Is it true that you tested out exactly how much better these lizard toes were at clinging to surfaces using a leaf blower?
Yes, so we had two different experiments. One directly looking at the clinging capacity of toe pads of different sizes. Now, the leaf blower experiment was actually for an entirely different question. As we were heading back to Turks and Caicos, we really weren't sure whether the lizards were, what they were going to do during the hurricanes. Were they going to hold on tight or run down into the roots of a tree? So if they ran into the roots, then of course survival would just be kind of random. It wouldn't necessarily be related to their toe pads. So we decided to test lizard behavior during hurricane force winds. So we caught the biggest leaf blower we could find, packed it in our luggage, brought it with us to Turks and Caicos, and set it up in the field. So basically the setup was a leaf blower, a wind speed meter, an experimental perch, which was just a wooden dowel, and then lots of netting and padding. And we filmed the lizards holding on as the wind speeds increased.
It's quite an image that you evoke. You're there with a leaf blower, basically trying to recreate a hurricane and launch lizards, hopefully not too far.
That's right. And we learned actually a couple of things. The first was that lizards, first and foremost, stayed on their perches. And second is they actually reposition themselves to be behind the perch, so kind of in the lee of the perch. But this left their back legs jutting out on either side of the perch, catching wind. And it actually gave us a really particular insight because we had a really surprising result when we crunched the numbers. We found that even though the arms had gotten longer, as we had predicted, the legs had actually gotten significantly shorter. We really didn't have any predictions for why this might be. But as we were watching the videos, we realized that as they were standing on these perches, their back legs, specifically their thighs, caught more and more wind like a sail until eventually the back legs were often blown right off the perch, potentially giving us an explanation for why shorter hind limbs might be advantageous.
No lizards were harmed in the making of this experiment.
Exactly. And all were safely returned back to their original point of capture after we were done.
So this fascinating trend with hurricanes, I know you only went back 6 weeks after your original visit, but grip your toes, shorter legs, are these traits going to be passed on to future generations?
That's an open question that we're really anxious to find out. It's entirely possible that this next generation is going to look a lot like the survivors that we had seen after the hurricane. It's also possible that this new generation will look like that baseline population that we had seen before the hurricanes. We're hoping to go back and investigate exactly that.
So I gather this is the first change to a species, at least that you know of, that's been documented after a hurricane. But there has been work showing that things like droughts and cold spells can spur natural selection. So I'm just wondering if you can give me a few examples of that.
Yeah, of course. So the famous example is Darwin's finches in the Galapagos with major changes to their beaks following drought conditions. There was actually an even more recent study. Remember the polar vortex a few years ago? The polar vortex actually selected for lizards with an increased cold tolerance. So there's another example of selection due to an extreme climate event.
And does that suggest that lizards are, I don't know what species those were, but lizards generally are quite adaptable?
Well, lizards are a really useful study system, but I don't think these patterns are unique to lizards. I think we are going to be finding more and more examples of these kinds of dynamics playing out due to extreme climate events all over the animal kingdom and the plant kingdom, for that matter.
Colin Donahue, a postdoctoral researcher at Harvard, his research on anole lizards was published this week in the journal Nature. Colin, thanks very much.
Thanks. It was a pleasure talking with you.
Sticky Lizards, The Islands. Feels like there's only one choice for our walk-off music today.
Hang on, Snoopy. Snoopy, hang on.
This is Jamaica's own Desmond Dekker. Three decades after he recorded his classic hit, Israelites, in 1968, Dekker decided to go back to the oldies and record the McCoys' big 1965 hit, Hang on Sloopy. And it's just been re-released on a posthumous Desmond Dekker album called Ska Master. So we leave you and the Lizards with a moment of inspiration and a reminder that it's almost Friday. The world comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Hang on tight, everybody. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
Public Radio International.